A Portrait of the Scientist as a Young Woman, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. With a tip of the space helmet to James Joyce, that opening line is the title of a great new memoir about the making of a scientist and leader. We last met Lindy Elkins-Tanton in our May 4 episode when I suited up for a clean room visit with the Psyche spacecraft. Lindy is principal investigator for that first ever mission to a metal asteroid. I told her at the time how much I loved her new book and how much I looked forward to talking with her about it. Stay tuned for some dramatic surprises. And you'll want to stay tuned even longer for a chance to win the book when Bruce Betts arrives with the new space trivia contest. Bruce also has a rare cosmic lineup for us to celebrate. Seeing the image that leads the June 10 edition of the Downlink, you might be forgiven for thinking a spacecraft had landed on the Little Prince's B612 asteroid. It's actually a fisheye selfie taken by that Mars-exploring pioneer, Pathfinder, back in 1997. Yeah, 25 years ago. Pathfinder and its Sojourner rover are also featured on the cover of the June Solstice issue of the Planetary Report, our great magazine, that you can read for free at planetary.org, just like the Downlink. And it's in the Downlink that you'll also learn about the big event planned for July 12. That's when NASA will share the first science images from the James Webb Space Telescope. My society colleagues and I can hardly wait to see what will be revealed. Lindy Elkins-Tanton is a Foundation and Regents Professor in Arizona State University's School of Earth and Space Exploration. She's also the Vice President of the ASU Interplanetary Initiative and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences last year. Google asteroid 8252 Elkins-Tanton. It's not the one her Psyche spacecraft will arrive at in January of 2026, if all goes well. That object is also called Psyche. This new rich conversation with Lindy lasted nearly an hour and covers much more than we have time for here, including her research expeditions to Siberia. You can hear it all at planetary.org/radio and everywhere else podcasts are found. Lindy, as I said, a couple of months ago, I couldn't wait to get you back on the show after that brief visit in the clean room when we were in our bunny suits to talk specifically about this really outstanding book that you have written, this memoir of a young scientist, to play with the title a little bit. So welcome. I'm delighted to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really thrilled to be here, Matt.
So let's get something out of the way right away, and that is the status of your mission, Psyche, which at this point, I guess, is really the status of the spacecraft since you're not launching for a while yet.
That's right. We are definitely gunning to make it a launch in 2022. We did slip our launch readiness date out into September because we're having challenges with our flight software. And of course, we can't launch until we know that the flight software is going to work. This is not where we hope to be. We hope to be clean and ready to go. But mission success is the number one priority, and the team is just doing an amazing job. And so keep your fingers crossed. We are still hoping to go in 2022.
You said it in the book, and we say it all the time, space is hard. Oh, this is the kind of thing you run into.
It is. It just is. And I have to tell you, building the spacecraft during COVID, that's been something else. And needless to say, you could imagine that when we wrote all of our budgets and our schedules and were selected back in 2017, we didn't have global pandemic schedule margin built in. So the fact that we even are as in good shape as we are actually just fills me with pride and gratitude for this team of people.
And we're going to talk more about your pride in this team and how it was brought together largely by you, because that's really key to what the book builds to, I think. Outstanding book. I don't think I have ever read a memoir that does a better job of demonstrating how someone's life and lessons learned prepared them for leadership while also describing how others can take advantage of these lessons, because correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed that that was one of your purposes. There are rules, if not to live by, at least to consider in this book.
That is so lovely of you to say. And to the extent that anyone would agree that I'm prepared for leadership, that was certainly the goal. And I hesitate to ever say that I have advice, but I have examples. Here's what I tried and here's what happened. And I hope that that is really helpful to people. And that is indeed one of the purposes of the book.
There are so many wonderful passages in the book. There is great, inspiring prose. Here's an example, just two sentences. There is great beauty in the depth of knowledge humans have collected. I wish with all my heart that every person could, in at least one discipline, pursue and come to know through a long path traveled all that has been discovered right to the edge of human understanding. What a lovely thing to say.
Oh, I feel that so deeply. It's the kind of magic that people who go the academic route often don't encounter personally, viscerally, until they're well into their PhD. But wouldn't it be great if everyone on Earth understood the limits of human knowledge, what it is to be an expert, how to decide your opinion? We grow up in a kind of a school-created miasma of believing that things are known. You look in a textbook, you think it's known. You look in a textbook, you think there's no room for me in that story. But it turns out, you know, most things that we think we know are going to be at least altered by future knowledge. And the things we don't know are so outnumbered the things that we know. And I think that that perspective, which I know that you have clearly with your own work, changes how you see the world and humanity and the choices that we make.
What about the title of the book? I assume you took your inspiration from James Joyce, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which is another story of how someone matures and grows into their potential.
Yes. You know, I'm such a literary writing kind of groupie. I have to admit, I did not think of this title. It was my brilliant editor, but I really loved it when he thought of it. There's a lot less Catholic angst in my book than there is in Joyce's book. But I think the point of it also is to point out the fact that even still in the current day, most people don't immediately think of a young woman as a scientist. Mm. And so that's part of the purpose of the title as well.
All right. So you learn, you practice, you lead, and as a result, you find yourself, well, no, you put yourself in the lead of creation of a proposal for this mission to a kind of asteroid that has never been visited before. You pull together this tremendous team, and the first proposal, the step one proposal, is coming together, and you learn you have cancer.
Yeah. Jeez. That was unbelievable.
Were you tempted, once you got into this and learned what it was going to take and what you had to go through to deal with it? I mean, were you ever tempted to push aside this mission, hand it off, or maybe also your new job at Arizona State University?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't, and I don't think that this speaks totally to my complete sanity, because I really wasn't. You know, I came into this new job to be the director of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. I moved from Washington, D.C. and Boston out to Arizona, and big school, about 350 people on payroll. We're in 10 different buildings. By the time I stepped out of the directorship, our research volume was about $65 million a year. So it was a big endeavor. And 6 weeks after I arrived, I learned I had ovarian cancer. And I thought, okay, I can, you know, we can get past this, and like, how serious is this? And luckily it was very early stage. So I was super lucky. It was the great doctors at Mayo who caught it for me, because otherwise that would have been it eventually. And so at that moment, I was still completely focused on the great new job and writing the proposal, and I'm going to get over this surgery and I'll be all better. What I didn't anticipate was how hard chemotherapy was going to be. At that moment, we weren't even confident I needed chemotherapy. In the end, we decided I would. Everybody has different reactions, and there are many kinds of chemotherapy, and I had a hard time with mine. Long story short, I was a mess physically. So I should have thought, could I step down from this job or at least go on hiatus, or could I just hand over the proposal to someone else? But in the end, the thing I really wanted to just not do was the chemotherapy and worry about the cancer, because what I really cared about, what motivated me every day, was the job and the proposal. And so my unbelievably lovely family, especially my husband, James, who cooked for me every day and even drove me to work to let me keep doing this thing that was so emotionally motivating for me. I mean, he would have been so within his rights to say, okay, stop it. Just stay home and rest. It will be so much easier on both of us. But instead, he would drive me to work and he would let me pursue this passion, knowing that it was what got me up and got me going every day.
Yeah, it was part of your therapy.
It was totally a part of my therapy. And so thank God for the proposal and the job, and thank God for my family and friends.
And you had this tremendous team that you had put together to carry on as you did the best you could, resulting eventually in this 218-page step one document, which was obviously pretty successful considering where you are now. How do you feel as you look back on that document today?
Oh, I'm really proud of the work that we did. And I got to pick, on a higher level, kind of our partners and a bunch of our team members. And then within each partner, they would choose teams. And I would always talk with them about what we were trying to do to create teams where the junior people could speak up and tell us about issues and that everyone's voice would be heard. And it began to pull in better and better people. And that step one proposal was beautiful. And we all loved it. And we celebrated it. Different team members had different amounts of faith, but I think on the whole, we did not expect to win. You don't expect to win the first time through. There were 28 proposals competing. And then we found out we were one of five selected to go on. And boy, that was a great moment. That was like a giant birthday that I never even knew I had coming. That was great.
And I think it says a lot that these five, Veritas, Da Vinci Plus, Lucy, NeoCam, and your mission, Psyche, they would all eventually be selected for development by NASA to go to space. I think it says something about the competition that you were up against. You have this wonderful story of how you prepared for, it may beat Siberia as the most dramatic episode in the book, the presentation that you and your team needed to make in person that could really make or break the mission. And the preparations that you made for it, which are just mind-boggling. I mean, just one example, you had the chairs in the room oiled.
Yeah. Yeah, this was like a Hollywood super production. It was, for many of us, we commented on this, one of the most dramatic, if not the most dramatic episodes of our working lives. All of us moved to Palo Alto to be there next to Maxar a week ahead, and we get encoded email with the questions we need to answer.
Maxar was your private sector partner.
Thank you, yes.
You were actually basing the spacecraft on their bus that they use to build, low Earth orbit satellites.
So important, yes. Yeah. So Maxar, at the time, Space Systems Loral, we chose them for our industry partner for the Psyche mission way back, I think, in the end of 2013, because we could use their smallest regular production model satellite bus and a solar electric power system at a huge cost savings to having something built bespoke from scratch. And they've been a fantastic partner to us, but they had not yet ever been a prime with NASA on a deep space mission. And so we needed to show the review panel that they really deserve this. And so we held the site visit at their unbelievable manufacturing facility in Palo Alto with the world's just, it's not the world's gigantic, most gigantic, but to me it was the world's most gigantic high bay, just filled with satellites all being built one after the next, because we wanted the review panel to see what this company could do.
I have to ask you to tell this anecdote about what happened during this meeting when you're playing host, you have key participants on the mission team arrayed around you. You had done everything you could to prepare. So you went into it, I think, feeling fairly confident. But then there were some curveballs thrown. And one of those, you had to sort of, what do they call it on those game shows where somebody has to make a call out to a friend?
Phone a friend.
Yeah. You had to bring in somebody who we know very well at the Planetary Society, Jim Bell, your colleague at ASU, the guy that I think I even when you and I were in the clean room together, I called the Ansel Adams of planetary photography or yes. Mars photography. You had to bring in Jim to respond to this. So could you tell that story briefly?
We of course spent literally years thinking about what were our weak points and how do we make them stronger and how are people going to receive this proposal. And we were certain that the review panel was going to be filled with questions about our gamma ray and neutron spectrometer, this gorgeous instrument that Applied Physics Lab has built for the mission. And so David Lawrence, the lead of that instrument, had a suit so he could present, and he was showed up early and he's all ready. And what we were not expecting was that instead, almost all the questions would come in about the imagers, which Jim Bell leads, and the magnetometers led by Ben Weiss. And so we had to call them when the questions came in and said, you need to get here right away. You need to get here early. You need to have your suit because you're going to be presenting. And so Ben even had to ask his wife, fabulous scientist Tanya Bosek, to FedEx his suit out. So they were not ready. And so there's Jim Bell suddenly presenting to the team, to the review panel in a big room full of a million people on well-oiled chairs. And he was kind of under attack from one of the review panel people who had a lot of really pointed questions for him. Not all of those questions even made perfect sense. Some of them were great questions, some of them not so much. And we were nervous about how Jim was going to be able to handle this in real time. And he spent a lot of time just walking back and forth thoughtfully, asking for the question to be restated, handling it in the most professional and amazing way, and getting through that part of the review. But that was a moment where I think everyone's hair was standing on end. It's quite a moment.
Tell me about that day when you expected the call to come from NASA, but you didn't know which way it would go.
Oh, my goodness. My husband and I, and often our son and his wife, Liz, spend our Christmas holiday up in a little house in Western Massachusetts. And so that's where I was in 2017, Christmas 2016, beginning of 2017. We got the word that NASA was going to be calling and telling people who won and who lost. And I had to tell them that in the house where we were up in Massachusetts, I don't really get cell phone coverage. And we have a landline, but no answering machine. So I had carefully arranged that they would call on the landline, and we had a time and a date. Like, I knew exactly when they were going to call me and say yes or no. So I spent sort of a week in therapy with James preparing to be told no, so that I would be okay with it and life would go on. And I felt so much responsibility for everybody. And so I slept really well the night before. And then I was wakened by my cell phone ringing early the next morning. And I could hear it was Thomas Zurbuchen from NASA on the other end. And all I could say was call on the landline. Because we'd get cut off. And then he would call back, call on the landline. I think it took like two or three times before he understood he had to call on the landline. And he'd wakened me, and it was a couple hours before I was expecting the call. And for whatever blessed reason, I was sound asleep. And he could tell I couldn't, you know, you can't immediately clear your voice and sound alert. And so it was super embarrassing in many ways. But then as soon as he could speak clearly, he said, I think I've wakened you, but I think you're going to be glad. And then I knew that we won.
Absolutely marvelous. You finished the book, or very nearly the end of the book, back in the room where you and I last met, all bundled up to protect that spacecraft, which was sitting right in front of us and was much bigger than I expected it to be.
It's huge. I know.
And so now you're at the Cape. You're going to be ready for launch, resolve those software problems, right? When do we reach this fascinating object out there, this asteroid like nothing else that has ever been visited?
Well, launching in 2022 gets us there 3.4 years, and then we will go into orbit around this amazing asteroid, and we don't really know what it is. All of our data from Earth says that it's largely made of metal, and it'll be the first metallic surface that humans will ever see or investigate. And the thing I especially want all the people kind enough to listen to us to know is that Jim Bell has led the development of a pipeline that will put the images from the cameras out on the internet within a half hour of our receipt. We're not going to edit them. We're not going to censor them. We want everyone in the world to share in the wonder of exploring a new kind of body all at the same time.
Thank you, Lindy. This has absolutely been a delight.
I appreciate your time and thoughts so much, Matt. Thanks so much.
Lindy Elkins Tanton of Arizona State University is the principal investigator for the Psyche mission to a metal asteroid. Her new book, A Portrait of the Scientist as a Young Woman, has just been published by William Morrow. Planetary Radio continues with Bruce Betts in a minute.
There's so much going on in the world of space science and exploration, and we're here to share it with you. Hi, I'm Sarah, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Want more space? We've got the latest news, pretty planetary pictures, and Planetary Society publications on our social media channels. You can find the Planetary Society on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. I hope you'll like and subscribe so you never miss the next exciting update from the world of planetary science.
Hi, I'm Bruce Betts. Will you help defend Earth? The Planetary Society is working to protect our world from an asteroid impact. It's the only large-scale natural disaster we can prevent. But we're not ready yet. Right now, your support can be doubled. A generous member of the Society will match all gifts up to a total of $15,000. It's a great opportunity to make a difference. You can learn more at planetary.org/defendEarth. That's planetary.org/defendEarth.
It's time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. It's Bruce Betts. Welcome once again.
Thank you, Matt. Welcome to you.
You know what? I wasn't going to mention it because we're not going to give it away till next week, but you recognize this, don't you?
I sure do, Matt. He's showing me on the video a picture of my newest book.
Solar System Reference for Teens, a Fascinating Guide to Our Planets, Moons, Space Programs, and More. Yeah, it's about to come out. It's already out on Kindle, right?
Yes.
And maybe probably is from other people as an ebook. Fair mention to others as well. But anyway, we'll have more to say about it next week when we give away a copy. What would you like to say this week about the sky?
I'd like to return to that thing I keep returning to because it's so cool, which is the pre-dawn east. Pre-dawn east has all five of the planets you can see with just your eyes all lined up in a beautiful line going from low down on the horizon up to upwards. They're even in order from the sun to make it even more exciting. So lowest down is bright Mercury, up higher than that is super bright Venus, then up to, well, if you look down at your feet, you'll see Earth. And then if you look then up to the upper right, you'll see reddish Mars and then bright Jupiter and yellowish Saturn all strung out. And we get the moon joining during this time frame. So on this June 17th, the moon will be hanging out at the upper end by Saturn. And over the 11 days or so after that, it'll keep moving down till it's hanging out near Mercury on the 28th. And Mercury will be quite low.
I think it's so cool that they're all in order.
Yeah, it took me a while to arrange that.
Good work.
Yeah, and it's been, I think, like 20 years since they played this game and being in order in a line. I don't know.
Extremely cool.
All right, let us move on to this week in space history. I was the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, this week in 1963, and this week, 20 years later, the first American in space, Sally Ride.
American woman in space.
Picky. Yes, I forgot a key word. Sorry about that. Thank you for catching that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sally Ride, who is mentioned very prominently, plays quite a role in Lori Garver's new book, which we will be talking about on this show in a couple of weeks.
We move on to Random Space Fact.
Hey, that K-pop group still wants to talk to you.
Nice. It's not nine muses, is it?
No, it's only eight.
It's about all I knew about K-pop, and they're all women. So maybe if BTS is looking, I'm so hip. I use the word hip. Let us get to the cool fact. We're talking Psyche mission, and from NASA's Psyche mission website. Not so random today. The size of the spacecraft with its solar panels. They say picture a smart car in the middle of a singles tennis court. The solar panels are huge. They're almost as big as the singles tennis court. And the smart car represents the spacecraft in the middle of all that.
They are huge.
You've seen that spacecraft.
I did. They no longer had one of the solar wings deployed. You can see pictures of those on the website. They didn't have room in that huge JPL clean room to unfold both of them at the same time. That's how big it is.
That's a big clean room with some big solar sails. Oh, wait, they're not solar sails. They're solar cells. They're solar panels. I think I heard squeaking from the dog toy that was correcting me.
Let's go on to the contest.
I pointed out and then asked you a question. On the Apollo 11 Goodwill Messages disc left on the moon, this was a disc with a bunch of messages from heads of state, etc. According to NASA at the time, messages from the leaders of how many countries other than the U.S. are included on that disc that was left on the moon? How'd we do, Matt?
Got a good response to this one. I think it took off in people's imaginations, just imagining this little disc sitting up there on the moon, waiting for somebody to come by and pocket it, I suppose. I hope not. Here's the answer, provided, as we often get it, from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. NASA took a small white pouch and launched it to the moon. And when the Eagle landed there, they found it opportune to drop the disc of silicon from countries here on Earth that leaders, count them, 73, had signed for what it's worth. 73?
73. 73 leaders of countries other than the U.S. sent messages along.
Here's our winner. He's a past winner. It took a year and a half for his name to come up again, but congratulations, Hudson Ansley, who had that magic number, 73. Hudson, congrats again. We're going to send you a rubber asteroid, a Planetary Society kick asteroid rubber asteroid. I think we're ready to move along.
This one's straightforward. I was surprised that, as far as I can tell, I've never asked this. Who was the first woman to fly in space twice?
Oh.
Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Okay, you have until the 22nd, June 22nd at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this one. And can you guess the answer? Or excuse me, the prize? It's a copy of A Portrait of the Scientist as a Young Woman, published by William Morrow, that terrific memoir by today's guest, Lindy Elkins-Tanton. And that can be yours if you're chosen by random.org and come up with the right answer for Bruce when we get together again next time. We're done.
Very cool. All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about what your favorite dog squeaky toy is or would be or could be or you want it to be. Thank you and good night.
Does this mean I have to leave the squeaky toy noise in the show, in the segment? Maybe so.
No, I think it's flexible. It depends on how it works out. If you include it, then it's connected. And if you don't include it, it seems like I've done my job to be random.
I'm not sure what you're... Are you saying the squeaky toy is flexible? That's good to know.
Yeah. It's okay, Gracie. We'll get you a squeaky toy soon.
And by the way, we won't have that winner for 2 weeks, obviously, because that's how it works around here, where we do What's Up every week with the chief scientist of the Planetary Society and his squeaky dogs, Bruce Betts. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its steely-eyed members. Mark Hilverda and Ray Poletta are our associate producers. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.